All right. Thanksgiving Eve trademark. Part two. We have, we lost some people there, I'm pretty sure. And some people who are here are barely awake. That's okay. All right. Let's, American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology versus Johnson Powell. Oh, here's the people coming back in. Ms. Ye, is that yours? Okay.
So in this case, this Dr. Johnson Powell, psychiatrist, and she was, I can't believe she was doing this, but she was falsely claiming that she was American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology certified on her resume.
She did, but not to the point of putting down a certification registration number or anything, did she?
Yes.
Oh, she did? She put down a fake number? Okay.
Which was inadvertent.
Was it? I'm sure that was an inadvertent clerical error. Did she make that point?
Yes. Yeah. It was so ridiculous. So, anyway, so she...
What's your favorite part first?
The affidavit. How the court relied on the affidavit. How is that...
She said, I won't do it again.
I'm going to do it.
I'm trustworthy. My favorite part was here at the bottom of 532. She also indicated that she no longer engages in the business of testifying as an expert witness. Really? I wonder why that is. Ah, Dr. Johnson Bell, now begins the impeachment of my life. Thank you for showing up to court today. I have this stack of paper with which to prove you a dirty liar who's not trustworthy at all. Your Honor, I'll need 5 days for this cross-examination. Out of the business of expert testimony. Wow. Okay. Sorry, I don't mean to steal your thunder, but okay, so keep going on.
So, anyway, so she's just this, crazy person who claimed that she was certified and wasn't, and she even,
let me just point out something. You said she's a crazy person. What kind of doctor is she? She's a doctor for crazy people? Okay, I just want to make sure I was understanding everything. Okay, thank you for illuminating that for me.
So basically, the American Board of Psychiatry, ABPN, they got a temporary restraining order, ex parte, and then they applied for a preliminary injunction while the case was going on. But the trial court denied their preliminary injunction, so they're appealing from that denial. I don't know how the trial court denied it. I mean, I know that this appeals court is saying that they can't really second guess the trial court unless there's an abuse of discretion, but I just think it's ridiculous that the trial court denied this preliminary injunction. They listed four factors that the trial court was supposed to consider: the likelihood of success on the merits, which everyone seemed to agree there was, and second was whether the plaintiff risked suffering irreparable harm if the injunction is not granted. I guess they said no, just because, I think based on the second portion of the analysis that she was voluntarily reformed or something, that she wasn't likely to infringe again, and so the plaintiff would not suffer irreparable harm during this during the rest of this case. So, and then the third factor was whether such injury outweighs the harm that injunctive relief would cause for the defendant, and the fourth, whether the public interest would be adversely affected by granting or denying the injunction. So,
and there's a lot of harm against the defendant right here, because if there's an injunction entered against her, and she won't be able to claim that she's a member of the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. Oh, wait, she said she wasn't going to do that anyway. Okay.
Right. And I don't see how she could be harmed if it's just not true, and she can't do it anyway. It doesn't make any sense. So anyway, ABPN, they challenged... They said that based on past case law in this jurisdiction, that if there's a likelihood of irreparable harm, that which the trial court said there was, if there was a likelihood of successful merits, which the trial court said there was, there should be a presumption of irreparable harm. And such a presumption. So, and then the appeals court just said, well, basically, that the trial court could have plausibly determined that there was a remote likelihood that she was going to overbridge again, which is what they did, and so the appeals court didn't want to second-guess them, essentially. So then ABPN also challenged their finding of fact that that she wouldn't infringe in the future. They challenged, you know, they said that there really is clear evidence that she probably would, since she's done it in the past. But then they talked about this voluntary reformation because she filed this affidavit that she wouldn't do any of this again, and that she stopped doing this and hadn't testified since, like, a year ago or a year prior to this case. And so, and then, you know, I think the appeals court, they seem to say that, well, it's just a preliminary injunction and they can still ask for a permanent injunction later, but, I mean, it seems to me that's kind of strange, too, because if you don't have enough to get a temporary injunction, you know, and the trial court doesn't want to grant it anyway, then how could you have enough for a permanent unless she infringes again, which they already said is not likely to happen because it's going to reflect badly on her.
Now, give me your argument for, let's say I'm this judge who has a soft spot for lying crazy psychiatrist in the district court. Give me your argument for irreparable harm, other than the one that was shot down here, that she said she wouldn't do it again, and that irreparable harm is usually presumed in trademark cases. Give me your best argument for irreparable harm.
Well, I think there's going to be irreparable harm even if she says that she's not going to, because if ABPN can't show that they can strictly enforce...
Talk as the lawyer for ABPN.
Okay. Basically, if my client cannot show that this court is willing to enforce, or any court is willing to enforce strictly their trademark and actually bring some kind of injunction against infringers, then their reputation is going to be irreparably harmed because any of their because their members or the public is going to think that people can just, you know, purport to be members of their association and not have any enforcement against them.
But Ms. Ye, your client brought the suit. That would seem to answer your concern about the ABPN being seen in the community as someone who doesn't care about the enforcement of its certification mark. The ABPN has brought suit. So what harm, that being public knowledge, what harm, let me just ask you this. Let's say that she does have a little bit too much to drink down at Malibu Dan's or whatever's down here, and lets it slip that she's a member of the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology late on a Thursday night. So what? A few patrons in a bar hear it. So what?
Well, no, but it's kind of a slippery slope, because it's just that if ABPN does not have a remedy that they can enforce in the form of an injunction against her, then...
But you'll have one at the end of trial, though. This is for a preliminary injunction.
We'll have a permanent injunction?
Well, I didn't mean to say that. Maybe you will. But for a preliminary injunction, in the meantime, she lets it slip over cocktails a few times. Hey, by the way, I'm going to... member of the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. What's the harm? Say 10 people. She tells that to 10 people.
Well, but the harm is that if she's allowed to do that and ABPN doesn't have any...
But she's not allowed to do that. This is not a question of the rule of law failing or something. She's certainly not allowed to do it, but if she does it anyway, what harm comes from her actually telling that?
I mean, the harm is that the harm is that she, that is that I guess potentially it could get out that she isn't and that there was no way to actually enforce it against her. There was no way to punish her for it, essentially, and so then...
So that everyone will go around claiming that they're a member of the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology? Is that your fear?
There may be psychiatrists that hear of the fact that you can represent yourself to be a member and nothing will happen to you. And then their reputation as being a certification board will just go down the tubes because they can't enforce it, essentially.
Well, good. Okay. I like that. I like that. That's very good.
I would have gone for, hey, if this woman tells just one person she's a member of the Board of Psychiatry and Neurology, that one person is going to stay away from members of the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology for the rest of his or her life and tell all of their family members to do the same. This woman is a walking patient zero for ruining the reputation of the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. Okay,
irreparable harm just because it's one person. Yeah, that's harm we can't repair. What are we going to do?
Go around hanging out at Malibu Dan? Hey, by the way, the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology—they're good people. They're much smarter than that crazy woman who was in here Thursday. We can't repair that kind of harm.
Okay, but yours was good too. I just wanted to do a little moot court. Okay, so what is this case really turn on? Because it really sounds like the appellate court would have granted the preliminary injunction themselves.
Well, I mean, I felt like it was just that they refused to second guess the factual findings of the district court.
Why?
Because they said that the district court is better positioned than ourselves to observe the nuances of these matters. So I think,
but they don't believe that.
Well, I think maybe they didn't want to second guess the district court, and it did seem like maybe they.
But frankly, they did second guess the district court. If you don't even have to read between the lines, but they're saying the district court is an idiot, aren't they?
Yeah, but.
They wanted to second guess the district court. Well, why did they hold themselves back? Yes,
right.
Something standard of something new.
Standard review.
Yes, this whole case is about standard of review.
Right, because they said that there had to be clear error in order for that to overturn.
And it's not quite clear. So it's all about standard review. So take this case in a lesson as how important your judge is. Because even if the law is on your side, there's a lot that the judge can do here. In trademark, patent, and copyright cases, whoever wins a preliminary injunction, and let me just go off the book here and talk about this for a second, because this is something you've got to understand. Whoever wins a preliminary injunction often has won the case in reality at that point, because a case can take years to resolve on the merits. Okay? And trademark business things happen fast. And if a preliminary injunction says you got to stop selling this kind of tire, you got to stop doing this right now, then you may not be able to wait a year, 2 years until the case is resolved on the merits. So preliminary injunctions can end things really quickly. Often things settle after a preliminary injunction ruling comes down. So preliminary injunctions are very important, more than just irreparable harm and that stuff, but they're important because in many cases, in many intellectual property cases, they are case enders. And the discovery for preliminary injunctions happens very, very quickly. You can get a TRO, temporary restraining order, ex parte, which means you don't have to give notice to the other side. You have to try to give them notice, but you can go in there and you can get a temporary restraining order for 10 days. And that will last for 10 days. And in that time, you've got to prepare for a hearing on a preliminary injunction, which will last until the trial is, the proceeding is resolved on the merits after trial or after summary judgment if the case is disposed of on summary judgment. So in that 10 days, you're doing document discovery, you're deposing people as quickly as you can, you usually do it on a voluntary basis, or else the court's going to get mad at you. So you do all this quick discovery, you put testimony, and you can put witnesses up at the preliminary injunction hearing. This happens in 10 days. It is not fun if you're an associate working on one of these for those 10 days. And then you have a decision that is so important that it can just end the case right there. Because the reality of it is that if you're enjoined from undertaking some kind of business for as long as it takes to dispose of the trial, in a lot of lines of business, that's just a business ender right there. Mr. Jones.
Doesn't Federal Rules of Procedure 65C prevent against that, though? Because it didn't say an applicant for preliminary injunction must post a bond designed to cover any costs and prevent the defendant ultimately deciding that the injunction should not have been issued.
Yeah, but it just doesn't. Yes, you have to post a bond, but it just doesn't.
That's the nature of, the nature of a preliminary injunction is it's supposed to be for something that can't be handled with the mere exchange of money. And so a bond, while it's a necessary component of the system, doesn't really make up for it. Mr. Peterson?
The largest bond you've ever seen or heard of.
Well, that's interesting because I read of some case recently where, oh yeah, it was the, here, someone can look this up who has Wi-Fi. It was Texaco versus Pennzoil. This was in the late 80s or early 90s. Jamail was the plaintiff's attorney, Jamail, and I think it came up to the Supreme Court on the issue of the bond. The bond was after the entry of judgment for it was a money judgment, and they wanted to appeal the money judgment, but in order to appeal a money judgment, you have to post a bond for some percentage of the money judgment. You can't just say, we're not going to pay anything. You have to post a bond for part of it. And the bond itself was $1 billion, I think. The judgment might have been $10 billion, and the rule was you had to post a bond for 10% of that, and they just couldn't. There was no way they could come up with a $1 billion bond. Has anyone found it in the meantime?
$12 billion.
It was a $12 billion bond. Well, there you go.
So that was
when the issue. That happens, and it comes down to the bond. In like a preliminary judgment, what occurs?
Read this Supreme Court case. It talks all about it. There's definitely some due process issues there. It's good Fed courts or constitutional law question, but it's really we'll leave it unturned for trademark class. But the Pennzoil versus Texaco Supreme Court decision addresses exactly that. I thought it was pretty impressive. I came up with the site. You're like, well, what's the answer, Professor? Hey, that's not even in trademark law, man. I was right there with the name of the counsel and everything. Okay. Bishop versus Equinox. Thank you, Ms. Ye. That was great, by the way. Bishop versus Equinox. Yes. Mr. Sorley. Sorry. Go ahead.
First party Bishop had a registered trademark or product. The trademark was Essence of Life, what they called it. The second company, called Equinox, had a different product. They weren't competitors, but they used this Essence of Life in their product. And Bishop wrote them a letter, this Equinox, however, did not stop and they kept on using it. Bishop then filed suit for an injunction. They also were trying to get attorney's fees as well as accounting of profits. So the district court said, we're going to grant the injunction. We're also going to give you attorney's fees because it was deliberate and willful because they did not cease and desist once they got the letter. And you can get attorney's fees in exceptional circumstances as here when it's deliberate and willful. But district court said that you have to have actual damages to get accounting of profits. On appeal, however, the court reversed and remanded because they said you do not need actual damages to get accounting of profits. There's two circumstances where you can get accounting of profits when there are not actual damages. One is when there's unjust enrichment, and the second is when there's willful infringement, as the court already said there was. So when they look at if you can get accounting of profits or not, it's an equitable consideration, and so there's many different factors. One, of course, would be if there were actual damages. They look at if there's unjust enrichment and if there's willful infringement. The court said, well, we can't determine if there is indeed, if there would have been indeed a different different outcome. So they reversed and remanded district court, and they wanted district court to determine if there should be accounting of profits, but that you don't need actual damages.
What was the most interesting part of this case to you?
It wasn't too interesting.
Not an acceptable answer. Most interesting part. Okay. You could have just said, I thought Essence for Life was a goofy name for a vitamin. I would have accepted that.
I thought the note for the other case was a big typo.
Yes, aware reasonable attorney fees.
I thought that was interesting.
Will you send a memo to Mr. Shags at Mr. Mags? Shags and Mechter. I mean, Mr. Mags and Mr. Schechter. If you have copious extra time, what?
One thing I think was, I guess, interesting was when they're talking about attorney's fees, they talked about how it was more of something like the trademark law. But when I was at a firm, it seemed like in circumstances like this, you can get attorney's fees in other cases that didn't have to be the trademark. It seemed like a ton of across the board litigational. Circumstance that, you know, for willful conduct of that sort, usually you can get attorney's fees. Or
in the American courts, you can only get attorney's fees if you've agreed in advance in a contract that if the contract's litigated, so, you know, the winner will get attorney's fees. Or if there's a specific statutory authorization for them, as there is here. But generally, even if conduct is willful and really opprobrious, that in itself does not allow for an award of attorney's fees. Other countries are different. Now, there are many statutory authorizations, especially in federal law, for awards of attorney's fees. But the default rule is still no attorney's fees. So I wanted to compare this to patent. You know, broadly speaking, in trademark, you can get the higher of your losses or the other guy's wrongful gains. Now, in patent, you can only get your losses. So if a big guy picks on a little guy, or reasonable royalties, they are entitled only to reasonable royalties or their losses. Now, if it's a small company that was, you know, a small software company that's working out of some high school student's apartment, and he's selling discs at his high school of some interesting software, frankly, at high school. So the only people buying them are the three people on the chess team and five mathletes, because no one else is that interested in high school. And meanwhile, Microsoft comes in and infringes on its patent and develop some new multi-billion dollar market off of that. He's either entitled to his lost sales, which are nothing, or reasonable royalties. But reasonable royalties might be something like 5% of the retail But if Microsoft developed a whole new market that's worth billions of dollars, that may be nothing compared to a royalty of 5%. So patent damages are much more limited than trademark damages here. So in many circumstances, you can get the other guy's wrongful gains. It's better for the little guy in trademark. Now, at the bottom of 535 here, the last paragraph, notwithstanding the existence of these theories of recovery, we recognize that a finding of actual damage remains an important factor in determining whether an award of profits is appropriate. Why? That's my first question here, Mr. Sorley. And then, more importantly, we are mindful that an award of profits requires a showing that defendant's actions were willful or in bad faith. Why should we have that requirement?
I think with accounting of profits, as we also mentioned, there's a big concern that it's just windfall to the, it could be just windfall to the plaintiff. And therefore, it needs to be such conduct that is so bad, so willful, or in bad faith as to get this type of award. I mean, somebody's using your trademark and you have no damages. And why should you be able to get
that? I just want to be careful about the use of the word damages, because when you say you have no damages or no actual damages, what we mean here, and because courts may use these terms inconsistently, so I just want it to be clear what we mean. We mean that you can't prove any lost profits or lost income. Okay. So you say if the plaintiff were entitled to the defendant's wrongful gains, it would be a windfall for the plaintiff.
Not
right?
Always, but there's
it, it could be.
It could be.
And that's why you have the requirement of the willfulness, etc. So why isn't that? Let's say that the big defendant didn't do this trademark infringement willfully, okay? But they ended up making billions of dollars off of using this trademark this way, and it in fact belonged to the plaintiff. So it's not willful, but why isn't that a windfall for the big company?
Well, I think these are also just kind of factors and not elements. They did mention unjust enrichment, which I think would be appropriate to look at in this case.
Unjust enrichment and windfall are basically the same thing. The term windfall comes from this idea that you harvest grain, so you've cut it off of the stalks, and then the wind comes along and blows it onto your neighbor's property. It's a windfall. They get all this grain that they hadn't seeded or tended to throughout the year, and thus unjust enrichment. Remember the case in contracts where the guy goes over to his neighbor's house when the storm comes because he was away, and he harvests all his grain for him and puts it in his silos, puts it in the neighbor's silos and takes care of all that stuff, and the neighbor comes back and says, oh, I see you did all this work for me, and the guy says, hey, how about, paying me for this work? No, that's all right, but, you know, thanks, chump. So that's unjust enrichment. So my question is, now, if Microsoft uses my software patent and makes all that money off of it, that's my intellectual property, that is unjust enrichment. And the patent law doesn't care, but that is unjust enrichment. They were enriched. I'm saying it's unjust enrichment. It doesn't really come up under patent law, but whether they did it willfully or not, that was my intellectual property. That was my patent I came up with. That was my patent to exploit or to try to make something out of. And just because I was a small fry and I can't prove lost sales, man, they made a killing off of my invention. That's my thing. I would argue, hey, that's a windfall for Microsoft. Now, in trademark, why don't we have this attitude? If the big guy comes along and picks up the little guy's trademark and makes a killing off of it, regardless of willfulness, why don't you just say, hey, big guy, that's a windfall for you, and therefore, the plaintiff has just as much of a right to it as you do.
Well, if someone's making tons of money off your trademark, it's quite reasonable that that little company will find out about it soon and send a little letter and say stop, you know, before they go and make $1 million.
Yeah, okay, but you're not answering my question. I'm trying to get at the justice of the matter, Ms. Nance.
Well,
what happened to your husband? Was he that bad?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, trademark law, though, is all about source, and if you have this little teeny company and supposedly a big bad company is using their trademark, I mean, the question really is, are consumers confused when the big company uses their trademark unintentionally? I mean, there's no bad motive. I think it's highly unlikely consumers are confused, so the purposes of trademark aren't being furthered by imposing additional damages, whereas the little company, you know, yeah, stinks for them, but at the same time, they're supposed to develop the goodwill behind that trademark. Whereas a patent, yeah, it's your invention. You know, you reward creativity. With trademark, you need to develop some goodwill behind that so there's some identification with it.
Brilliant! Okay. Brilliant. Does everyone get that? Does anyone want to have it restated? Convince these people of what you're saying. They don't understand.
Patent law is about rewarding creativity. So once you create something, you get the reward of doing whatever you want with it for 20 years or 17 years, whenever your patent gets granted. And so when somebody takes that from you, they're taking your creation. Trademark law is not about creating a trademark, it's about identifying the source of your goods and building up goodwill behind your goods. And if you create a trademark, okay, well, good for you, but if you don't build up any goodwill behind it, and somebody else comes along and unintentionally uses it, and they build up goodwill, and there's no consumer confusion, that user should not be punished. Is that it basically restated?
Yeah, let me add another way of explaining it. Not to add anything to your point substantively, but just to try to add another way to explain it. Let's say that, so I gave the example of Microsoft taking off with my brilliant invention and making all that money off of my invention. What if I'm using the trademark Excel for my little spreadsheet and I sell it to 5 mathletes and 3 members of the chess team, and Microsoft, as the junior user, comes in later and uses the mark Excel to sell a spreadsheet program to hundreds of millions of people across the world, where's the value? In the patent, the value is in the innovation. In the trademark, the value is in the goodwill pertinent to the value is created by Microsoft. The value wasn't in the word Excel. The value was in Microsoft's building of that reputation. The goodwill belongs to Microsoft. Even if they use the trademark wrongfully, in reality, the feeling that people have of goodwill, that reputation, that's attached to Microsoft. Mr. Jones? Well, no. If I said that, I need to take that back out. Willfulness is not. I didn't mean to say they knew about it.
Not know that the trademark exists because they know the trademark exists, then it would be willful.
Yes.
They know the senior user exists. That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
Okay, then be willful.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Sorley.
I think along with this is also an interesting point with this case. In that Equinox, the second company, was a much larger company.
Yes, please talk about this.
With Bishop as, well, Equinox actually argued that Bishop no longer was using their mark and they abandoned it. Bishop was a small little company, yes, and hadn't been using the mark that much, but the court said no, Bishop didn't abandon it. So in this case, people, I think, much more recognize
essence
of life with Equinox than maybe Bishop, even though Bishop was the first one to register
the
mark.
So take it to the goal line. Keep going, what you're saying.
Well, the goal line going on with this is one reason that it's kind of an issue with the accounting of profits is, you know, with the essence of life that Equinox made their money possibly from that mark, people's source of essence of life is with Equinox. They shouldn't have to pay so much when just because some of the companies out there in North Dakota had registered that mark before.
Right, and the court, but the court gets mad about this big guy versus little guy thing, right? The very end of the opinion. The district court found that Equinox's infringement of Bishop's mark to be deliberate or willful. This conclusion was based on Equinox's failure to cease and desist from the use of the essence of life mark, despite its written commitment to do so. The court found that Equinox's decision to continue using the mark was not based on a reasonable belief that Bishop had abandoned the mark, but was instead premised on the relative economic weakness of Bishop's operation. After reviewing the record, we are not left with a... In other words, we agree. It's a bunch of negatives here, but after reviewing your record, we agree. Equinox is just saying, well, you know what, we don't think Bishop's going to be able to fight this. So it's absolute bullying, and the court doesn't like it. So, with acquiescence and latches, and here, with this issue of the big guy is the junior user, and the issue of damages, we have two more examples to add to our collection of ways in which the trademark system gets away from source. Acquiescence and latches, it's a general equitable defense. In a meaningful world, it seems we got to apply it to trademark. Hey, you've gone on a long time, NAACP and NAACP Legal Fund. We're going to let you both keep using the trademark, but you can't control one another's usage. No, we're not going to allow everyone to start calling themselves NAACP. Just because we're, you know, and I was corrected earlier, it's obviously Kellogg and Exxon did not find that there was acquiescence. But if there is acquiescence determined eventually in this case, that Kellogg acquiesced to Exxon's usage, then we're just going to end it there. We're not going to worry about source. Look, this guy's using the cartoon tiger, this guy's using the cartoon tiger, everybody take a rest, just take your cartoon tiger back to your corners. Doesn't mean everybody gets to use a cartoon tiger, but you guys just keep on using a cartoon tiger. And we're ignoring the fact that trademark's all about source. And so too here with damages for a much smaller senior user and a much bigger junior user, even though the goodwill really is built up by the junior user, it's just wrong, and we got to have some way to not put up with that stuff. This is like the Ameritech case, right? Where it was the little Ameritech in Ohio, and then the big phone company named itself Ameritech. Okay, so we got to have some way to protect these little guys. Even if, in reality, in terms of just thinking about source, all that goodwill really goes with the big junior user. So, now, Big O Tires, oh my goodness, I love this case, Big O Tires versus Goodyear, who has Ms. Visser.
All right, Big O Tires does business in 14 states and tire buying organization. Basically, they let independent retailers put the name Big O on their private branded tires. At the time of trial, the net worth was $200,000. And Goodyear has an after-tax income of $175 million.
Boom, boom, boom.
And
which brings to mind the Michelin Man, which is the wrong, sorry, I...
They actually manufacture their tires, and then they sell them to company-owned stores nationwide. So in this case, in the original case, Big O brought suit and asserted two claims. First, a false designation of origin claim, and second, a common law trademark infringement claim. So to understand the case, we need a timeline.
We're running out of time, so just skip to the yeah, you're right, we do need the try to skip the timeline. Let's see if we can skip it.
Okay. After trial, the jury found for Big O, they found that they had infringed on a trademark and they were deceptive. So they awarded them $2.8 million in compensatory damages and $16.8 million in punitive damages.
And how did they come up with $2.8 million in
Because they took, Goodyear had spent approximately $10 million in advertising. And so they took that number and they said, okay, well, Big O competes in 28% of the market as Goodyear, so we'll give them 28% of their advertising budget so that they can do corrective advertising in their market where they're both competitors. So that's where they got 28% of their original budget.
Well, there was in the district court, and I'm trying to get close to people today because of the audio recording. In the district court, the calculation was it not that how much did Goodyear spend? About $10 million, and Big O did business in 14 states.
Correct.
Right, and 14 of the 50 states equals 28%.
Right.
And so they got 28% of $10 million.
Correct.
That's the 2.8. Right.
Correct.
Now the thing you're talking about with the 25, the corrective advertising.
Well, the argument was that Big O now needed to come back and do corrective advertising
right.
because of Goodyear saying we sell Bigfoot tires, and we're the only people who sell Bigfoot tires.
And then there was some alternative theory about...
There's an alternative theory that the FTC, when there's a false advertising claim, they require the false advertiser to pay... and damages 25% of the budget that they spent.
How many people were kept awake at night after reading this case, by the way? Anyone? Oh, I think you're in for a shock then. Won't sleep tonight.
Yeah.
Okay. So
then on appeal, they combined those two.
Wait, but in the district court, they didn't talk about this FTC thing.
No.
When did the FTC thing come up?
On appeal, because Big O...
In the briefs?
No, oral argument.
On oral argument. Oh, by the way, before I sit down, I have this other thing to justify. 20%. 20% is pretty close to 25%, and that's how the FTC calculates the comparative advertising. Okay, now I'm done talking. Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the court seems to agree with all of this. Right?
All this stuff, they're agreeing, and then they get down to the third paragraph on 541, and it says, taking cognizance of this, all this stuff, we say that the maximum amount of the award is $678,302. You're like, what? And how did they get that figure?
Because they combined Big O's two rationales into one rationale.
Oh!
They only gave them 25% of their 28% of their advertising budget.
25% of 28%
of Goodyear's overall budget. So they gave them a quarter of their original of what the trial court gave.
Do you see what happened here, you guys? This is why this should keep you up at night. This attorney was like, "Oh, I have another good point." Ah! And he just lost millions of dollars. Should pay attention to law school. I just want to scare the heck out of you. Like, wow. I mean, and remember this, and we're making fun of it. This happened in the 70s, but this is a real attorney. This is not a made-up story. Can you imagine what this guy went through after this came down? Can you imagine being responsible for this? The appellate court doesn't say anything like, as everyone is aware, the FTC does, as we usually do in these cases. No, they just leave it out there like, oh, they mentioned this thing in an oral argument. Hey, we're going to use that to do this. I mean, the appeals court spares, it gives this guy nothing to think, but he is entirely responsible for losing his client millions of dollars. I think it's a really unfair way to draft that opinion, because, and remember I told you at the beginning of the semester, if you read nothing else in cases, be alert to the human drama that's going on. My gosh, this case is sobering and
scary to think about this. It's a real case that you guys are going to be lawyers. This happened to a lawyer. The guy could have sat down. But he said, oh, I count on this new theory.
Non-time to agree.
What's that?
I said non-time to agree.
Yeah. And just absolutely devastating. What's that? The second rationale was presented by Big O at oral argument. Well, that's a good question. What do you think? Yeah, well, in the end, Goodyear wrote a big check for Big O. It's not a big, at this time, wasn't very big. I'm not even sure the client figured this out. I won't ask for a show of hands, but I think it's clear that many of you guys did not see this Loch Ness monster just under the surface in its cave. But I think it's very possible the client, well, I don't know, when there's millions of dollars on the line, probably figured it out. I was on the phone today with Jack Culp, the owner and CEO of Traffix Devices, who he wanted me to pass along this story to you guys that this is the Supreme Court case on the Bendy signs, remember? And they were the plaintiff. They were the other guy was trying to say that Traffix can't use the dual spring design because they were now protecting it as trade dress after their utility patent had expired. And Jack thought this would be a good story for you guys. He said, you know, he was a little company and this other company was trying to run him out of business. And he thought, well, if I'm going to go for this, I'm going to go for this in a big way. I'm going to hire the best attorney I can. If we're going to take this to the Supreme Court, I'm going to just find the best Washington attorney who knows how to work these Washington things. And he got a hold of a guy, John Roberts, who argued this case brilliantly for him, got him a 9-0 decision. And Jack said when he was talking to John after the argument, he said, you know, I can tell that in your heart your ideal job, you'd rather be up there behind the bench, wouldn't you? And John said, yeah. And just within a few years, after his brief time on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So Jack is very proud of his Traffix decision and very proud of his close personal friend, John Roberts. I will see you next Wednesday for the last class. Thank you guys very much. Happy Thanksgiving to you. So, privileged. Have lots of friends. Have a big Rolodex. I hang out with the stars. You know, Jack Culp. Owner and president of Traffix Devices.